This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host, as we're here every Friday morning at around 9 o'clock, just after the news. Over the last couple of weeks, we've covered the questions of understanding polling. What does it mean? What does it not mean? How is it done? What should we infer from it? And I guess at some point in the future, we may revisit that as the local election begins to get closer and closer. We've done programs on the new season for the Johannesburg Ballet, including modern works this time, specially composed or choreographed, rather, for the session, including one of my favorite younger choreographers, Dada Masilo. And we did a program on a giant project outside of to look for the existence of dark matter, not to be confused with antimatter or black holes or the stuff that lives under your bed. And we were able to make use of the services of one of my wife's cousins who's in charge of the project. And I thought that was, you know, it was like a postgraduate program in nuclear physics all in 1 hour. If you haven't listened to it, please do, because it really is interesting. I learned lots, even though I thought I knew something about these things. But today we're going to circle back around to American politics, because it's been in the news a little bit and it affects most people. And we're going to call on our friend David Smith, the Guardian correspondent in Washington. I must tell you, David, that a couple of weeks back, I was walking through a shopping mall and somebody I don't know walked up to me and said, "When are you going to have that very nice man, David Smith, back on air?" First of all, since we're radio, we wonder just exactly how she knew who I was. The idea of leaping up from a table in a restaurant to tell me this, that was a little bit frightening. But second, I think what it does is it speaks to your circumstances and character as a man who can understand the South African fascination with American politics, even if it lacks some understanding of it. And it's topical because the U.S. is having an election, South Africa is having one, 68 other countries on the planet are having an election this year, including Russia, where, of course, we already know who's going to win. So that's not much of a problem. India is about to have one. Indonesia, an overlooked country sometimes, has just had one. No surprises there, but it was free and fair for the most part. And there are dozens of other countries that are gearing up to having these or figuring out ways to shut them down. But we're going to turn to David because he is the man who gets to try to unravel the mysteries of American politics for a global audience by virtue of the paper that he works with and works for, The Guardian. David, thank you again for joining with us.
Hi, great to be here. And I'm delighted to hear that Dada Masilo is still going strong. I was a fan of her work in the days that I lived in Johannesburg.
No, she's gone strength to strength. She's... One of her projects is a reimagining of Hamlet, of all things.
Terrific.
And that's not the work that's coming up shortly, but she's got a shorter work. Hamlet should be entertaining, liberating, frightening because of what she does with the classics. She doesn't destroy them. She just looks at them carefully and reimagines them a bit. But let's turn to the U.S. and American elections. It's been kind of an eventful week in American politics, and it's not going to end because you have another night of watching the president's State of the Union message, which will have come, because people will be listening to this Friday morning, which will have come in a week in which Donald Trump basically ended the Republican primary season by winning almost all of the primaries in Super Tuesday. Even if in each of them, except I think one or two, a significant minority of people voting on the Republican side of things chose not to vote for him, but in fact voted for Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina and Donald Trump's ambassador to the UN. Your observations of how this week has unraveled or raveled up, I'm not sure which way to use the verb anymore.
It's a bumper week for me. Tuesday night at Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's luxurious estate in Palm Beach, Florida, and then Thursday night at the U.S. Capitol for Joe Biden's State of the Union address. So I'll be able to do a compare and contrast these two very different personalities. And really, this week has confirmed that it's going to be Joe Biden versus Donald Trump all over again in the 2024 presidential election. And you may hear a groan of unenthusiasm from millions of Americans at that prospect, having lived through it once in 2020. Here are the two oldest candidates in history, Biden 81 and Trump 77. And a lot of people wish we didn't have to have this replay, but it's happening. And on Super Tuesday, which is the biggest night of the primary election calendar, there were 15 or 16 states taking part, and Trump and Biden really wrapped up their nominations effectively. Trump won 15 out of 16 Republican contests. The only one he lost to Nikki Haley was Vermont, but Trump won big ones like California and Texas, really pushed the whole thing beyond doubt. I was at his speech at Mar-a-Lago, which I found pretty subdued and dark. No champagne corks popping, no balloons, no family on stage, no confetti. Trump came out, spoke for 19 minutes, and it was doom and gloom about the United States. Really, the central message was America sucks, and I'm the man to fix it. Very joyless in terms of this dark vision of the nation, which was strange because his central argument is that millions of illegal immigrants are fighting to come to the US. Why would they come if it's such a dark and depressing place? But anyway, the following morning, Nikki Haley dropped out of the race. Some people were surprised she had lasted so long, but I think Super Tuesday was going to be the final nail in the coffin, and certainly the donors, the fundraisers who are crucial to these things, would have pulled the plug. Notably, she did not endorse Donald Trump, but she said he has to work to earn the votes of her and her supporters, you know, expand his reach, perhaps moderate a bit. We'll see about that. Certainly on social media, he talks about her getting trounced. It was pretty derogatory. And what Super Tuesday had earlier primary results showed is that Trump still has weaknesses and vulnerabilities. I mean, on Super Tuesday, Nikki Haley got about a quarter of the Republican votes available. Trump is still struggling with people who studied at college, people who are living in the suburbs, struggling with women. He has to expand his reach. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, Biden, of course, is the incumbent, so he was always going to win this nomination. One of his rivals, Dean Phillips, has now dropped out. He never made much impact. His other rival is Marianne Williamson, a self-help author, but you know, they came nowhere near to Biden. What was notable, however, was that in Minnesota, campaign known as Uncommitted, which is groups urging people to write uncommitted on their ballot paper in protest over Biden's handling of the war in Gaza. That notched about 18-19% of the vote. Strong showing. And there's, again, a warning sign for Biden there that he may face further protests over the Gaza war. And you know, if enough people of that mindset just decide to stay at home or vote for a third party candidate, that could make all the difference in some crucial swing states in November.
We're going to take a quick station break and we'll be right back after these messages. This is the Deep Dive and I'm Brooke Spector, and I'm pleased that my guest is our friend David Smith of The Guardian, Washington correspondent for that global newspaper. He's being run all over the country to listen to campaigns and campaign speeches. Before we go to the break, I want to pose a question to you. Just think about it for a second. Why in a country with so many younger political figures are we, and this is a question I'm sure you've thought about a lot, why is it the battle of the gerontocracy going on? Let's take that break and then we'll come back to you, David, and then I'll hear your view on that.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And our guest today is David Smith, Washington correspondent for the Guardian newspaper, longtime acquaintance from his service in Africa, and now, of course, in Washington. Just before the break, I posed a question to David about why in a country with such an enormous range of political figures who are less than four score in 10 years, I guess. Why is political choice for president among two people who are basically, let's face it, old? Why are we there?
It is a great question. Biden 81, Trump 77. I think part of it is the baby boomer generation after the Second World War was numerous. It's actually just a bigger generation than many that followed. In politics, they also seem to have been quite good at consolidating power once that generation came into office. They didn't want to give it up, because it's not just Biden and Trump, of course, but in Congress as well, we've had a series of elderly figures who finally, at long last, are now relinquishing power. You know, Nancy Pelosi stood down as Speaker of the House of Representatives a year or two ago. Mitch McConnell, Republican minority leader of the Senate, just last week announced he was stepping down from that role. And by the way, despite all his animosity with Donald Trump, has endorsed Trump for president now. But yeah, it is striking that, you know, Biden, Trump, well, if you look at Trump, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, those three men were all born within a few months of each other. I think in 1946, Biden is older than them all. And I have one final theory as to why Biden and Trump now have dominated the presidency for so long. And it's, I would argue, it's growth of fear in America. Really, the last decade or so, been this violent swing between hope and fear. Barack Obama famously represented hope for millions of people, but I think he symbolized fear for white Christian America, conservatives, people on the right. Conversely, Trump represented hope for a certain section of the population, but definitely represents fear for millions of people. And when you're fearful, you tend to cling to what you know, the default, you know, what seems safe. And certainly, I think in this cycle, you know, Democrats just do not dare experiment with a young candidate such as Pete Buttigieg, who is openly gay, a female candidate such as Kamala Harris, the current vice president, other women, other people of color. There's just so much calculation of, oh, maybe America's not ready for that. Maybe it would be too risky. And, you know, this is not the time to take a gamble. We really need to play safe with Biden, a safe pair of hands. He's beaten Trump once. Surely he can do it again. And surely America will be able to tolerate a white male. And some of that, I think, is going on the Republican side as well. But also on the Republican side, it's just such a cult of personality around Donald Trump. His age is not so central to that. It's just who he is, the celebrity, the aspirational businessman, and so on. And you know, he has a stranglehold on that party that we saw in the Republican primary. About a dozen people tried to challenge him. No one got close. Some even tried to imitate him and become mini Trumps. And you know, some of them, like Ron DeSantis, were far younger. The age didn't matter so much. You know, nobody was going to go for the bootleg Beatles when they could have the authentic original.
I mean, when I was growing up in the U.S., and all right, I was growing up back at the age when we were still killing mammoths with sharpened spears, I guess, in the Pleistocene, and trying to invent fire. The idea was that a seasoned politician, somebody in their late 50s and maybe even early 60s, was about the upper limit of what one would expect from a leader. I mean, Ike Eisenhower was in his 60s and was considered an elder statesman virtually. And then you had the run of people like Kennedy and Johnson, who was not appreciably older than Kennedy, really, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter, all of whom were younger members of what was still then the baby boomer generation. And now suddenly we're confronted with two people. All right, they're roughly my age, but people who are clearly older. Now, Biden, you would think, would be able to project the aura, experience, wisdom, knowledge. Nothing rattles him. There has been some economic success during his tenure in office. Inflation is down. Unemployment is way down. Job creation is way up. And yet, if you read the polling, Joe Biden, it comes in a distinctive second place to Donald Trump in terms of who would be a better economic manager for the country. Frankly, I mean, I realize that's what's being said, but I don't quite understand why the lag in perception about the economic circumstances of the country. I've read all kinds of analyses of it, and I still don't quite get a hold of why this has taken such a deep root.
No, quite. And I think that's certainly one of the biggest mysteries in Washington and something confounding the White House. Just by the way, on the age issue, Biden, I think, sometimes does try to use it as a strength, saying it, you know, his experience is invaluable, particularly on foreign policy. But there is a perception that of frailty and stumbling over words and things. Whereas Trump, he's only 4 years younger, but I saw him in action a couple of weeks ago at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And I would have to admit, Trump came over as very energetic, at times quite funny. He had the audience laughing. He was fired up. He did not seem like a 77-year-old, and he just presents younger than Biden, which is going to be an issue there. But on the economy, it's certainly true that statistics data show America's had the best economic recovery of any major industrial country since the pandemic. I think it's about 14 million jobs created. Inflation was a problem, but generally coming down. All sorts of indicators that show the economy is healthy. It avoided a recession that many people were predicting, and yet people are just not feeling it. They do not give Biden credit for that. He has a very low approval rating on the economy and is far behind Trump. I think one or two reasons for this may be that inflation has been relatively high, not necessarily compared to European countries, but still high for America. And people get a visceral shock when they buy petrol for their car or go to the grocery store and buy milk or eggs or other things. And that sticks with them. And the White House would say, yes, but people's wages are also increasing. And in fact, by some measures, you know, wages have actually caught up or overtaken inflation. But even there, there's a problem in that it's possible that, you know, people, when their wages go up, they credit themselves. And when prices in the stores go up, they tend to blame the government. And it's just one of those cognitive dissonance things. People are blaming Biden for the negatives here. The hope in the White House, I think, is that there's still several months into the election. Hopefully, they think the economic good news will percolate through. People will realize, actually, these are good times economically. And obviously, Trump and Republicans are going to do everything they can to present a negative image and claim, you know, things were much better under Trump. So it's a communication messaging challenge for the White House. I think they're aware that you can't just tell people they've never had it so good. You have to wait for them to feel it themselves.
We're going to take another quick break, station break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we're pleased that once again we can call on the observations and insights of David Smith, the Guardian correspondent in Washington and, of course, formerly in Africa. We'll be right back after this.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. This is Brooke Spector, your host, and our guest today is David Smith, The Guardian's correspondent in Washington. We've been talking about the processes of the election going forward and the perceptions. You still that? Yes, you are. Okay. The perceptions of people on economic circumstances. And we haven't yet mentioned, except in a very, very gentle way, the interaction of foreign, international relations, foreign affairs on the American electoral process. And I think the preeminent on that cliff or that hill, of course, is the war in Ukraine, the fighting in Gaza between Hamas and Israel, and now most recently, the problems in Haiti, which is just, 200 kilometers or so from the southern extremity of Florida. How is foreigners often see foreign policy as the key to elections. Americans usually see it in kitchen table economic issues. But I think in some way, foreign policy has woven itself into the dialogue and discourse in an unusual pattern for America this year. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the conventional wisdom is that foreign policy does not decide American elections, and people are more concerned with the economy and other domestic issues. But I was struck a couple of weeks ago at the Conservative Political Action Conference known as CPAC, where Donald Trump spoke. And it's this, these days, a far-right get-together with not necessarily even conservatives, but certainly it's a festival of Trumpism, if you like. And the entire theme was, this is where globalism goes to die. And there were many speakers talking about international affairs, in particular of how the US should not get involved in foreign entanglements. It was really the Trump America First isolationist ideology. And you had senators such as J.D. Vance really arguing against continued support of Ukraine and getting cheered for it. That the general mood then, and people I spoke to said, we've done enough for Ukraine. Why should I care? And I think that kind of perspective is trickling through to Republicans in Congress. Been deadlock for months now over an agreement to give further financial aid to Ukraine and Israel. By the way, interestingly, Trump himself has less to say on the issue of Gaza. I guess he doesn't see any particular political upside for himself. He just makes very general claims about how if he was still president, Ukraine would not have been attacked. Israel would not have been attacked. The world would have been a place of peace and prosperity. And Trump says only he can prevent World War III from happening. But in general, and as I mentioned on the Democratic side as well, the biggest rebellion really so far against Joe Biden is on the issue of Gaza. There are plenty of progressives and people on the left who think he's just been too staunchly pro-Israel from the beginning. He has failed to rein in Benjamin Netanyahu, even as an estimated 30,000 Palestinians have now died. The UN has talked about a famine there, people literally dying of starvation. And if the Biden approach was to hug Netanyahu close in order to gain leverage and behind the scenes persuade him to show restraint, indications are that that has failed. And in states such as Michigan and Minnesota with big Arab American and Muslim populations, there's a very visceral, very palpable anger at Biden. They basically accuse him of complicity in genocide, of betraying the Muslims, Palestinian Americans, and others who supported him. These protest votes are aiming to change that policy. At least some of those people may refuse to vote for Biden in November. We shall see if they follow through on that. But certainly, in that sense, foreign policy is looming very large for both men.
The other two foreign policy issues, in a way, one of course is the immigration question, which is now apparently the single biggest issue. If you read the polls thoroughly, immigration is obviously not simply from Mexico, but now includes many thousands of people from the rest of Latin America, from China, from the Middle East, and everywhere else who can get to someplace to get to the southern border of the U.S. And now, most recently, the general collapse of civil order in Haiti. The last time that happened, there were a lot of Haitians who fled to the U.S. And there are communities of Haitian Americans now in New York, Florida, and other places. Those are domestic stroke international issues all sort of intertwined into one.
Indeed. And I guess there's a lesson here in that was the Africa correspondent of The Guardian for 6.5 years based in Johannesburg, and obviously following South African and African news closely. And then when I moved to the United States, living in Washington, I was immediately struck by the insularity of America and its news media. I mean, it was, to this day, it's pretty hard to get much coverage of African news on U.S. cable news networks, or indeed much of the rest of the world. And on that point, even what you're describing in Haiti hasn't cut through much compared to the election and domestic concerns and so on and so on. And all of this is a wake-up call, as you're suggesting, I think, in that, America can't hide. It's part of the world. And what happens there has a huge impact on the southern border, which, as you also note, polls show has risen to the top concern of voters, even more than inflation. And it really has become the animating force of Donald Trump's election campaign. It's his signature issue. It's his central issue, which, of course, you know, going all the way back to 2015, 16, when he first ran for president, the very first day he promised to build a border wall. He talked about Mexican rapists and criminals flooding the country. He's recycling that in even more lurid terms now. And his speeches are dominated by that. They're peppered with references to millions of illegal immigrants stampeding across the border. And he'll go on these strange and rather baseless riffs about people coming from prisons and, as he puts it, insane asylums. Very oddly, he will claim that includes Dr. Hannibal Lecter from the movies. The other day at CPAC, he talked about prisoners from Congo flooding the US, which, again, I suspect is completely made up by him. He talked about people coming speaking languages that we've never heard of. It's all very racist and xenophobic and Trumpian. But it's typical Trump. It kind of touches on some reality, because under Biden, there have been record numbers of people coming to the border, a new record in December, slightly down so far this year. But it is a genuine concern now for millions of Americans, exacerbated by a Republican strategy of busing migrants to cities in the interior, you know, New York, Denver, Chicago, and so on. Democratic strongholds, that has put the issue front and center, and certainly Biden and the Democrats have to find a coherent strategy and response to show that they take this issue seriously.
We're speaking with David Smith, Guardian correspondent in Washington, longtime observer of African issues, which is why we choose to reach out to him when we can. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and my guest today, we'd like to call on him to help explain the intricacies, the oddities, the incongruities, the impossibilities of American political life. Of course, he's had a bumper week. There have been major primary elections all across the country. Donald Trump won a case, as it were, at the Supreme Court. He's allowed to be on the ballot, after all, in certain states. There was some thought that might not happen. Joe Biden, the incumbent president, has given his State of the Union speech. It's a speech that reviews the successes and, at least in an election year, is some springboard to the actual campaign, why he wants a second term. The judgments will come in about whether he was successful in offering a convincing rationale, whether he looked up-tempo, whether he looked excited, interested, or did he look frail. And I think that will be some measure of things. I want to move the discussion a little bit, because the election is not simply about the fates of two men. Hundreds and hundreds and thousands of other people who run for various offices in the U.S., and most importantly now, are congressional races, House of Representatives, all of whom have to stand for re-election, or there are vacancies that they would like to be elected to, about a third of the Senate. And there have been some important developments. Some men and women have decided they're no longer going to be members of Congress, House, or Senate. And there were some very interesting races that have come along. The one that intrigues me most, of course, is the one in California, the Senate race, which posits Adam Schiff, a congressman, who was the bête noire, I think, of Donald Trump in the impeachment hearings a couple of years back, running against Steve Garvey, who has no discernible political record, but was a star infielder for the Los Angeles Dodgers for forever. Talk to us a little bit about all the rest of this going on.
And if you'll indulge me, just one very quick add on what we're talking about with the border and immigration. I think the situation in Haiti illustrates that, you know, the only way you'll ever get long-term solutions to America's immigration crisis is to tackle it at the roots. And, you know, instability in the region and around the world, often a result of U.S. foreign policy in Central America and elsewhere. And that's the only long-term fix here. But, Super Tuesday was a bit dull at the presidential level, and some media rebranded it Stupor Tuesday. But there were, as you know, some interesting congressional and Senate races and so on. In California, they have a primary election which is open to everyone, Democrats and Republicans, known as a jungle primary. And Adam Schiff, longtime thorn in the side of Trump during investigations. Trump hates him, gives him nicknames such as Pencil Neck. He defeated two fellow Democrats, both to his left, including Katie Porter, who's quite a well-known member of the House. But Schiff was victorious. And I have read reports, I believe it's true, that Schiff ran some quite clever advertising about Steve Garvey, baseball guy you mentioned, really sort of tying him to Donald Trump, boosting his vote there in the knowledge that Garvey will be very easy for Schiff to beat in the general election in November. California is such a blue state these days. I think no Republican has won statewide since about 2006. You know, the days of Arnold Schwarzenegger being governor are fading. And so if you're a Democrat running for Senate there, you're pretty guaranteed to win these days, I think. And Schiff is relatively well known. And the thing about that is now, the Senate is so delicately poised. These races really are crucial. The next president, their ability to enact legislation, just get things done, can hinge just so vitally on who controls the Senate and the House. And we've seen some of that in recent months with the Biden presidency. Speaking of which, Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who was a Democrat, then became an independent, has announced she is not running for re-election in Arizona. That may be a pragmatic choice because opinion polls showed her trailing the Democrat Ruben Gallego and the Republican Carrie Lake, who, by the way, really is a Trumpy extremist and election denier. It's been interesting to watch the reactions to Sinema stepping down. Some senators really praise her, said she often did some really great work for good causes behind the scenes. But there's also been a ferocious backlash because even though she was ostensibly a Democrat, she really blocked Joe Biden at crucial moments, including reforming the filibuster, which is a strange Senate rule, and is seen as responsible for ultimately blocking abortion rights legislation, voting rights legislation, and so on. That Arizona Senate race will be critical. Obviously, many other Senate and House races vital in November. That the Senate map this time does tend to favor Republicans in terms of the seats that they don't have to defend many seats, and there are several where they have an opportunity to beat Democrats. Remembering, of course, in any given election cycle, don't have the entire Senate up for grabs. They move it in different cycles. But I think one other notable result from Super Tuesday is a man named Mark Robinson won the Republican nomination for governor of North Carolina. Many people would say he is also a very scary figure. He has said outrageous and odious things about gay people, about women, and where this, I think, ties in with your baseball example as well in California is that sadly today in politics, you know, fame is the new currency. In Robinson's case, you know, he made some speech somewhere, I think, about gun rights or some issue, and it went viral. And before you knew it, he was a MAGA star, a Make America Great Again star of the far right. And that's why you see people like Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene sometimes saying and doing outrageous things, wanting that viral clip that will give them the currency of celebrity. And that now tends to matter more than the blocking and tackling of years of work at council level and committee level and building political contacts and forming good policy. It's become a shortcut for many people.
I tend to refer to this as performative politics rather than actual politics. We're going to take another short break. We'll be right back. We'll sum up. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and my guest today, David Smith, Guardian correspondent in Washington. Political season in the U.S. is just really heating up, and he's already been worn down to a mere shadow of his former self. We'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest is David Smith, Guardian Newspapers. No, he hasn't actually been worn down. This is his meat and potatoes, if you will, and he's loving every minute of it. But because, David, you are a literary person, too, you've written plays, and I know you're a film buff of major portions. We trade insights into famous films like Casablanca frequently. When I think Donald Trump, what comes to my mind almost immediately is a collection of novels and films, or film stroke novels, primarily All the King's Men, the film The Flim Flam Man, The Last Hurrah, and a book that I'm sure you're familiar, Anthony Trollope's The Way We Live Now. Does Donald Trump strike you as a character in literature and cinema even more than a politician? Am I misunderstanding him?
No, I think that's right. I think you left one off your list, arguably, A Face in a Crowd from 1957. The rise of a media demagogue and the power over people. Another point I think that has sometimes been made is that, you know, Ronald Reagan was the movie president and Donald Trump is perhaps more the television president, given that he came from the world of reality TV, and should never be underestimated how important that was. You know, on The Apprentice, he played a charismatic businessman who knows what he's doing, he's in charge of things, he's very successful. And for years, that was imprinted on the minds of millions of viewers. I would also say, I think, Trump is larger than life. I mean, just think, even that name, Trump, has a slight absurdity to it. It's, you know, something an author would come up with. Normal people are not called Trump. And, you know, all his antics, there is obviously that well-worn saying, you know, you couldn't make it up, that he's actually bigger and wilder and more absurd than the imagination of any writer. I think for that reason, novelists might have difficulty with him. Some of it couldn't be made up. But also, there seems to be a lack of psychological depth there. He's not necessarily a great villain like Macbeth, with all the complexity. Trump just seems to operate in two dimensions and blurt out whatever's in his head. But given the outsized nature of him, I've often thought perhaps he'd be well suited to a musical or an opera, something on that kind of epic scale. And
I like the opera. I think the opera's a great idea.
I can sort of see that with the grand set of Mar-a-Lago and the White House and Mike Pence as some character and all of it. And obviously the Dynasty of the Children, Ivanka, there could be some mileage there. And I've been thinking of another, just one more, which is less obvious to add to your list of examples. There's a lesser known play by Arthur Miller called The Man Who Had All the Luck. And right now, Donald Trump does appear to be the man who had all the luck. Not only is he the Republican nominee, but as we know, of course, he's facing four criminal cases, 91 charges in total. Normally be devastating for a political candidate, but it just appears to be making him stronger. And right now, those cases are going just about as well as they possibly could for him. And by that, I mean the Supreme Court took up his appeal for immunity as president. And that means there's going to be a delay, the big federal criminal trial into Trump trying to overturn the 2020 election. Another case in Georgia on election interference is also in trouble because the prosecutor in that one had a romantic relationship with a colleague. So she might be pulled off that. That's also a delay. We don't know when we'll finally get stuck into the case around Trump's handling of classified material at his home. And so right now, the case that's most likely to get started is the one widely seen as the weakest. And that's the one about Trump paying hush money to an adult film star. Again, in any other context, any other universe, what I've just said would be career ending. You couldn't possibly run for president like that. But in this instance, that case is based on a slightly novel legal theory and will, you know, could well give ammunition to Trump and his allies who say this is all a political prosecution and shouldn't be happening. And of course, there's even a possibility Trump will be acquitted on that one, in which case that'll further strengthen him. And even if he's found guilty, that one is pretty unlikely to result in a prison sentence. But what it all means is he's, really riding his luck on those cases. He also has the good fortune to be up against an 81-year-old with a very low approval rating. Maybe he'll luck his way all the way to the White House in November. We shall have to see.
I mean, gamblers know that ultimately they have to check out of the game before the House starts its winning run. You bet against the House and you lose in almost every conceivable casino game. Donald Trump seems improbable, even though he lost money and bankrupted a casino. How in the world that ever happens? I can't visualize owning a casino and then having it go bankrupt. But never mind. He's managed to extend his string of luck for years without seemingly being wounded by any of it. We have just about 30 seconds left. What's the one thing you'd want us to watch for next?
Watch for Joe Biden, I think, trying to go on the offensive against Donald Trump now that he knows Trump is the nominee. Biden just talking about his own achievements will probably not be enough. He has to draw a contrast with Trump and really hammer home the message that this man poses an existential threat, not only to American democracy, but potentially the stability of the world. Russia is watching. China is watching. Trump may well pull the U.S. out of NATO if he wins. The stakes are incredibly high. And the question is, can Biden convey that to the American people?
Yeah, okay. Go negative and win.
I think they're both going to go extremely negative. And so when you talk to political pundits here, they say it's going to be the darkest, worst election in American history.
Fasten your seatbelt, folks. We have a long way to go. We've been speaking with and enjoying the company of David Smith, the Guardian newspaper's correspondent in Washington, who himself now has a long slog ahead of him until November of this year, covering an American election. We'll be back again next week on The Deep Dive. This is your host, Brooke Spector, and we will do other topics. We probably will cycle back toward local politics next week. We'll keep you guessing. Take care, and we'll talk to you again next Friday morning at 9 o'clock.